but don't brag or boast. Click my glass and say a toast. Unlock my love for you. How it runs so deep and true. And yet it's so. Cause don't you know?
Earthwatch was brought to you live, with portions on recording. Well, we are apparently waiting. I thought we would have this dramatic segue here. We're apparently waiting for the computer in here. Ah, there it goes. Howl, baby, howl. Oh dear, this computer needs a serious reboot. Don't we all? Good morning. This is Hour of the Wolf, a weekly program dedicated to science fiction, fantasy, enchantment, and the imagination. My name is Jim Freund. This morning, well, those terms, enchantment, fantasy, science fiction, and imagination, another way to express them would be Ray Bradbury. Stay tuned. Thank you. As mentioned, this is Hour of the Wolf. My name is Jim Freund. If you tuned in last week was even more freeform than this show is wont to be sometimes. I had an amazing writer, Felix Gilman, and his presence was facilitated by James Gates, who is a publicist and PR director of the Science Fiction Writers of America, and I had been working for her, more or less, at Book Expo of America, and we were co-working during the Nebula Awards earlier, about, is it already 3 weeks ago? I guess it is. And we were just going to chat and talk about science fiction, but it was announced earlier last Wednesday that Ray Bradbury had passed away. And which is, by the way, not the only sad passing in science fiction this week. Jim Young, who was a guest on this program several times, although I guess the last time was about 9 years ago, 8 or 9 years ago. Jim Young was a center of Minneapolis fandom, but he was also a good writer. He wrote a couple of short stories and an amazing novel, the name of which I'm blanking on, but you'll never think of hammerhead sharks in the same way. Before the end of the show, I'll tell you the name of the novel. Jim Young, Bradbury was 91. Jim lived up to his name. He was young. He's about my age, late 50s. And he had a brain tumor, it was announced last week, and he died yesterday. And is somebody who will also be missed. But Bradbury's passing is seismic worldwide. Jim Young was a great loss to the people who knew him. Bradbury was a huge loss to people who haven't even heard of him, necessarily. Although I think there are very, very few people who hadn't heard of him. And so last week, James and Felix and I just sort of extemporaneized? Ooh, there's a new word that should never be repeated ever again. We spoke extemporaneously. We did freeform radio, starting with Bradbury and reading a piece of his and two official obits. James read two official obits, one from the president of the Science Fiction Writers of America and the other from the president of the United States. I dare say it's the first time that a science fiction writer was given an obit by the president of the U.S. And, of course, by the way, the Republicans had to counter, I think it was McCain, saying, well, we like Bradbury, too. Bradbury was very much a universal speaker, and I think that was what people liked about him so much. He gave voice to some really deep, meaningful, wonderful things in so many ways. He was great as a first read. When you are learning to appreciate more sophisticated fiction as a youngster, in those days we didn't have the concept of young adult fiction. We had juveniles and we had books that weren't juveniles. And I mentioned stories last week on the air that I'm going to repeat because I assume, or rather I can't assume, that we have all the same listeners. And some of these stories are very formative to me about my reading and appreciation of Bradbury. That my uncle has a lot to answer for, had a lot to answer for. He's long gone. He died when I was about, about 14. But he did two things that were instrumental to my life, one of which was he got me reading science fiction, and number two was he introduced me to the sounds of WBAI. So as I said, he had a lot to answer for. And one of the first series of books that he gave me were short stories by Ray Bradbury. And that was furthered, only slightly mistakenly, by my parents, who gave me the books S is for Space and R is for Rocket, because the titles sounded like they were for young people, and they're not. They're short story collections, totally adult. And I read them, and I didn't necessarily comprehend them, but they made me want to reach. They made me want to learn more. I read and loved and fully appreciated Bradbury's signature work, Fahrenheit 451. But the thing that spoke to me the most were probably the Martian Chronicles, because of my age and the idea of adventure. Bradbury picked up right from where Edgar Rice Burroughs left off. And he wrote about his love of the John Carter stories and Edgar Rice Burroughs. And by the way, speaking of the Nebula Awards and the John Carter stories, Genevieve Valentine was here earlier tonight. She was a Nebula nominee for Best Novel earlier this year. And she finally recorded for us her first movie review. And we're going to try to place those in several places on WBAI, but you should also read her novel, Mechanique. And I mention that in relation to John Carter, because those who were listening when we were offering John Joseph Adams' Barsoom book, New Adventures of John Carter, she was here live on the air reading her John Carter short story, a variant on Edgar Rice Burroughs' Chessmen of Mars. It was a wonderful work that she did there. Anyway, trying to get back on track. Bradbury picked up pretty much where Burroughs left off, but with more poetry. Bradbury always had poetry in his writing. And this was both among his strongest and weakest assets. But he was one of the first writers in science fiction to carry science fiction from the pulp era to the prose era, where writing mattered. The idea that he had prose, that he wrote in a manner that gave you pause and said, you know, I like the feel of that sentence in my mind that ran so well over my mind's eye. He did that beautifully. And he also followed through the kinds of things that people like Robert Heinlein were doing with universes, shorts, and Asimov, short stories that would lead to larger works, which is what ends up becoming the Martian Chronicles. So the Martian Chronicles were among my first favorite thing. And as a result of the Martian Chronicles, and here's a story I told last week, I was always a bad student in school, always, never made it through. But one of the things that I really got enthusiasm up for in the fifth grade, and fifth and sixth grade is where I ended up in a lot of trouble for book reports, but this was the first of them. In the fifth grade, I wrote a book report on the Martian Chronicles, and the teacher basically didn't look at it. The teacher gave me an F out of hands. And this is one of the few times I really made an effort. And it's like, why? And he said, well, it's not literature. It's science fiction. Well, that was those days. It's probably very confusing for a lot of people to think today, to think that it was regarded that way. But the very fact that something was science fiction relegated it to a literary ghetto that pulp magazines could never hope to get out of, even though at that point we're past the pulp era, we're into digests and all that. But science fiction was still that awful, awful stuff. At best, in that era, it became that Star Trek stuff. And Star Trek wasn't, you know, even that well-regarded, the original Star Trek. It was canceled by NBC, except for fan letters and stuff like that. And even then, it ran all of, what, three seasons. Today, it would be thought of differently. But that's how it was at that time. When this radio show began, when Margot Adler created Hour of the Wolf in 1972, and the Thursdays and Fridays, it was a five-day-a-week show, were science fiction shows. Science fiction was still in a literary ghetto. But we felt otherwise. We, as did most people in science fiction. Now, Margot actually left this program in order to go to the Clarion Science Fiction Writer Workshops, where one of her teachers, by the way, was Ursula K. Le Guin. Okay, footnote. Let me get back to that. Let me say that the play, The Lathe of Heaven, has now officially opened, and I can give you an official review. I actually need to write one up. But before, I was saying about how hopeful I was that it would be good because I'd seen Edward Einhorn's production of Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep? And we had it as a premium. If you subscribe to BAI, you got 2 free tickets to this show. Well, let me tell you now, if you didn't do that, you're lost. You can go and pay the full price, and it will be still worth every penny of it. This production proves once again that good literary science fiction, by the way, something that Bradbury has done, can be converted to stage. Bradbury wrote any number of stage productions of his short stories. But Edward Einhorn has done an incredible job with novels, and his production of The Lathe of Heaven is totally true to the novel. It actually highlights points that I had forgotten or didn't even necessarily fully understand about Taoism and stuff that were in Le Guin. And as a review in Theater Mania put it, it does it not didactically, but rather through expression and enchantment. And it does it so well. So that's a limited run if you are interested. Basically, it's at the TLD, Three-Legged Dog Arts and Technology Center at, I think it's 80 Greenwich Street, and you can Google that up and find out information. If it goes the way his production of Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep goes, it's under-attended initially, and then by the end of the run, you know, people are looking to pay outrageous prices to get tickets because these things are not going to move to Broadway. They're not. This is it. This is the production. Maybe they'll revive it in a few years. But for right now, that's it. I went to the opening day performance, by the way, and met people from the production of Peter and Wendy, which, Mabu Mines, and I was just so thrilled to meet them. But science fiction has a great place in theater, and now let us go back to that bookmark that I placed, and having mentioned Margot Adler, having gone off to the Clarion Science Fiction Writer Workshop, and having actually worked with Le Guin at that point, or studied under Le Guin, and, I put the bookmark there. What was that point? Well, I'm not sure. But nevertheless, I was telling the story of how I got failed for my book report at a young age, and that really helped put me off. We were talking about the ghetto that was science fiction even when Adler started the show. It is only over time that people have started moving out of it. And there is still that problem today. In fact, Le Guin is still in a dialogue with Margaret Atwood about not whether science fiction can be literature or not, but what the definitions of these things are and when does something start being science fiction and not, and, you know, can one be both? Well, suffice it to say, the last issue of The New Yorker was all about that. Unbelievably, The New Yorker had an entire science fiction issue, which included both Le Guin and Ray Bradbury. Well, fast forward to somewhere in the 1990s. It was the 40th anniversary of Fahrenheit 451. a book so important that it's still sometimes burned in schools in the U.S. At least it has been more than once in the last 10 years, which is a horrific thing to say, especially given and ironic given the content of the book. But Bradbury's people got in touch with the arts director of WBAI, who at the time was Matthew Finch. And Matthew, good soul that he was, made sure that I was involved in the interview. Bradbury came here to accept for the 40th anniversary of Fahrenheit 451 the National Book Award. And I got the ultimate revenge. It's almost, you know, Max Schmid would tell you this is Gene Shepard-like, where years later and everybody is, you know, crying over, oh, what did I do and all that. Bradbury actually recorded for me a message to the teacher who flunked me for the Martian Chronicles on the day that he was receiving the National Book Award. I mean, that's a wet dream fantasy. And I got to live it. It was quite something. So, what we do have is the interview between myself, Matthew French, and Ray Bradbury from that day. And Max Schmid's name gets mentioned here again, because I had this tape on a 7-inch reel, oxide tape, and a little over a year ago, for Bradbury's 90th birthday, Max was putting together this tremendous, no doubt soon to be repeated, premium for WBAI, consisting of all things Bradbury and radio. And we included this interview. And in order to do it, Max had to bake the reel. I actually have a couple of places, and I'll repost them, a picture of what the reel looked like after it was baked. I mean, literally put into an oven at a low temperature. You can add cupcakes, but they probably taste poorly. And the reel warped and all that. But Max was able to extract the tape itself, and then cleaning the tape recorder with the oxide on it every, I don't know how often, playing the thing backwards, and then equalizing it and all that, we were able to restore this interview. And that one was only, you know, 15 years old. Imagine some of the tapes I've got now. I've got tapes that are well over 40 years old, and they're probably in better condition than that. They used to make them better. The old stuff holds up better than the newer stuff. And thank God that we all have it digitized now. But also thank Max, because he was the one who did this incredible job. So, set your way back machine to somewhere in the mid-1990s, early to mid-1990s. It's to when Ray Bradbury received the National Book Award for Fahrenheit 451 at the studios of WBAI, at that time at 505 8th Avenue. And here it is.
Hello, I am Jim Freund. With me is Matthew Finch and Ray Bradbury. Ray Bradbury is one of those people who certainly need no introduction, but perhaps a reminder of what he has done is in order, because his work has covered so much of a scope that it's easy to forget some of those things that we take for granted. He has worked in just about every medium that exists, in radio, in television. He has authored 65 screenplays of his more than 500 short stories. He's written for the stage. He has been adapted or written 5 movies, including the screenplay of Moby Dick for John Huston. Am I missing any media?
A couple of operas, a musical with Jose Feliciano called The Wonderful Ice Cream Suit, and maybe it'll be here in New York sometime in the next year and a half. Off Broadway, of course. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't believe in big theaters. I like small ones.
You began writing at about age 12 in the 30s.
Mm-hmm.
And you've seen a lot of history of literature and history of this country pass by in the scope of your writing. It was in the 40s, I believe, that you wrote The Fireman?
The late 40s, early 50s.
Of course, it would have to be
because
of the politics of that time.
Well, the politics really got rough around 1949, and John Huston and Lauren Bacall, people like that, Bogart, came back to Washington, D.C. There was a guy named Parnell Thomas, who was head of the House Un-American Activities Committee. He was McCarthy long before McCarthy, huh? And all the Hollywood people came out and turned tail and went home when one of the people who was supposed to testify didn't do a good job. It was stupid. I can't remember his name. And Jack Warner said, "Everyone home," and they all went home. And it sort of perked along there, and then McCarthy took over with Bobby Kennedy, of all people, you know. And everyone's forgotten that. It was very sad. And
Were you already working with John Huston at that time?
No, I met John Huston when I was 31 in 1951. And on St. Valentine's night, I gave him all my books, and I said, "It's very simple. I love you. I love your films. Here's The Illustrated Man. Here's The Martian Chronicles. Here's Dark Carnival. And if you like these as much as I like your work, hire me someday." So he wrote me from Africa a couple of weeks later. He was doing The African Queen. And he says, "You're right, you know, someday we'll work together. I don't know on what, but I'll stay in touch." And in August of 53, he offered me the job of writing Moby Dick, and the rest is history.
Yeah, I didn't mean to derail you,
but
I had to know.
Yeah.
So you were talking about the late 40s and Parnell Thomas.
Yeah, yeah, who turned out to be a demi-criminal. I think they put him in jail a couple of years later.
Probably.
Something over income taxes, as I recall. Yeah.
Oh, got Al Capone and Spiro Agnew.
Anyway, long before that period, when I was a kid, I was a child of libraries. And when we'd go across country on Route 66 from Illinois to Tucson or Los Angeles, the first thing I did every night when we stopped to sleep overnight in the bungalow courts, that's what they were called, motels. They were a bungalow on stilts with chickens running wild underneath them, you know, a real primitive atmosphere. And I'd head for the nearest library. And when I get to the nearest library, whether it was Albuquerque or Amarillo or whatever, I'd check the shelves to see if there were any Oz books. There never were. Or any Tarzan books. There never were. And I could, and in some cases, a lot of other fantasy books that I wanted to see. And my perception of censorship grew at that time. It wasn't...
In the land of the free.
Yeah. Well, it wasn't a huge thing. You know, it was individual libraries. Yeah. There was no big movement. But a lot of intellectuals of both left and right have always been suspicious of fantasy. It didn't improve your mind, huh? Yeah. Turned it into mush. And a good example of that is in the early 50s, there was a psychiatrist who became famous by destroying the comic magazines, huh?
Yes.
And I can't remember his name.
Leslie Fielder?
No. Well, he'll come back. I'll call you at 3 in the morning.
Yeah, and I'm awake then.
But
let me just point out, by the way, that first of all, I started much of my reading because my parents gave me what they thought were two primers. R is for rocket and S is for space.
Yeah.
This started me on science fiction and has corrupted my life ever since.
I'm so
glad. That was the first thing that you did to me. The second thing that you did to me was turned me off school because I was failed in the sixth grade because I wrote a book report on the Martian Chronicles.
Ah.
And science fiction is not literature.
Oh, that's right.
Now it's required reading,
It's taken a lot of... I used to come back here, again, everything's in terms of 40, 43 years ago, and I used to come to New York, and I was publishing my first short stories and the Martian Chronicles, The Illustrated Man, and I'd go around to cocktail parties, and I'd meet people from the New York City Ballet in one room, and a bunch of lawyers and doctors in the other, and they all called me Buck Rogers and Flash Gordon. And there was no respect, huh? Okay. But every time I meet some of these people, I'd say, "Give me your name and address and phone number." And they'd say, "Why?" I said, "Because the night we land on the moon, I'm going to call you." because when the night we landed on the moon is the greatest night in history, huh? And we all wept together that night. I called three people and said, stupid son of a bitch, and hung up. Yeah.
But this also goes to show what was going on in terms of schools not allowing certain kinds of books to even be reviewed. I don't know if my book review was ever read or looked about. I was very proud of it.
Sure. Well, no, there was no perception. And people didn't mean to be mean. They just didn't understand that science fiction is the fiction of ideas. If you want to stimulate kids, the ideas are, it's like pomegranates, huh? The metaphors are there. It's mythological. It's in terms of Greek and Roman mythology, Egyptian. And the remarkable thing is this, that during the last 40 years, the pyramid has been turned on its upside down. The kids have taught the teachers, huh? Instead of the teachers teaching from the top down, the kids taught from the bottom up and said to the teachers, on a daily basis, they'd come in and throw a copy of Heinlein on the table and say, hey, here's Robert Heinlein's book. And, oh, that junk? Well, read the first paragraph, teacher. And that she'd read the first paragraph and say, hey, that's not too bad. And slowly, Heinlein and Clark and Asimov and myself moved into the school system. But it took the kids to do it. Huh?
One of the things about science fiction and the fact that it was so easily disregarded is that people were able to get great political comment and political statement into science fiction writing and science fiction film. Mm-hmm. A movie with the statement of the day the Earth stood still could not have existed if that same statement were put into a mainstream
That's
movie.
True. Unless, in book form, if some important writer decided to become science fictional overnight, huh? Like Jessamine West, who was a Quaker writer and a wonderful one. She wrote a little science fiction novel called The Pismire something or other about Pismire ants in the future. And she never did another piece of science fiction. But there are a lot of other people who've come into the field, like Gore Vidal a year ago with a piece of science fiction.
And he did Visit to a Small Planet in the 50s.
That's right, sure.
Well, and you also have Margaret Atwood. Who did?
That's right. Yes.
There's Margaret Atwood and Doris Lessing and Vonnegut
right.
always walked that line.
They're not very good at it. They're rather windy, huh? And they don't know how to control themselves.
That's in tribute, by the way. That background noise is
that
tribute
what that is?
To Fahrenheit 451.
All right. Fair enough.
I wanted to ask a question. When you're dealing with a book that's now 40 years old and that's in the company of Brave New World in 1984, which I think Fahrenheit 451 is, how fair is it to judge a book like that by its prescience, by its being able to accurately envision what is to come? Because there are so many details in here that are very chilling. And of those three writers, you're the only American. And there are numerous details in here that are very strong and very accurate, right down to the seashells that people wear in their ears. A seashell is a kind of radio transmitter you wear inside of your ear, almost exactly like a Walkman.
Yeah, when the Japanese invented that, they came to me. I was doing, they called, they wanted me to do a one-minute interview with Kirk Douglas in my office, 1 minute. And it was for a Japanese coffee company, actually. But they came to the office, and they brought with them the first Walkman radios. And there was about 50 of them. I mean, when the Japanese make a film, they make a film. These were all producers, huh? And they all had Walkmans, and they came in and said, oh, please try this on, you know, this Fahrenheit 451. So, and I was just so delighted that they identified me with their invention. It's fascinating. One doesn't want to be judged by one's prescience, but there is a thing in the book that really nails it, where we're living in a time of MTV, huh? And our commercials on television, a one-minute commercial has 120 images. There's no space for thought, huh? In some cases, 200 images. They're afraid you're going to get bored, huh? Our magazines show it. I have a thing there where the Fire Chief Beatty speaks of the things being shortened and turned into obituary notices. Time magazine now has a page, or did have a few weeks ago, for several months, of reviews of books that were 30 words long, a review of a film 35 words long, a review of a stage play 47 words long. My God, that's a long one. And you look at that page, you say, Jesus Christ. And all the other magazines are imitating USA News, huh? Everything is fragmentized, and so that the centrifuge turns and thought is flung off. Huh? There are no central ideas or metaphors, and all of our magazines are like that, and they're full of ads. I talked to all the leading editors and publishers of the best magazines and newspapers in the world 2 years ago in Phoenix, and I said, for shame, and I had a stack of magazines with me up on the platform. And I said, here is good housekeeping. I dare you to find the articles. Come on, find the articles. 300 pages of ads. And I had a poem in there once a couple of years ago. Couldn't find the damn poem. Called the magazine. I said, where's my poem? And they came back on. They said, it's page 275 opposite the Lysol ad. I said, thanks.
Yeah, yeah.
So,
and they're tremendously mixed messages, and especially in the women's magazines, between the health column and you turn the page, you can read an article about anorexia and how dangerous it is. Turn the page and there's your classic anorectic sitting there selling you her life as if it's wonderful.
Oh, yeah.
One of the things that really struck me is the Beatty. The chief fireman has a very long speech right dead center in the book. And one of the things he says about the death of books, or maybe death is too strong a word, but he says that this wasn't the state saying this stuff is bad. This was the state following the lead of the people gave up on it.
That's right. Yeah, it came from the bottom up, as with education today, that the good stuff comes up from the bottom too. Students teaching the teacher. But you don't have to burn the books if no one reads them. And if the teachers have given up teaching, you see, our problem today, we do not want to face it. Everyone's afraid of criticizing the teachers because it's a very powerful union, and they don't want to be criticized or tested, and they should. After all, I'm tested every day of my life. I've got a new novel out recently. It goes into the bookstores. If you don't like it, I'm out of business. Huh? My head's on the chopping block. Why shouldn't the teacher's head be on the chopping block, too? Why shouldn't she be tested at the end of each year, especially in the first grade, to teach reading? Because they're shoving them, all the students upstairs, second, third, and fourth grade. And those teachers have to take over the job, and it doesn't get done. Huh? So out of that, then, comes this terrible problem of the magazines trying to keep up with the morons, huh? Since no one's reading, you've got to put out a magazine for morons. And it's a catch-22. It keeps circling around itself.
Yeah, it's a little bit like our electoral system as well. I've always said that the largest voting bloc in the country is the fools. You know, it's caging the idiot vote is how you get elected.
It's otherwise known as the mental bloc.
Yeah,
organized.
That's right.
Well, it's true in almost every country. When you look at people get so confused, and then they hand over the power to a dictator or a guy who's I think there's a quote on the back of the book here from ancient Greece or Rome, in which the people give over their, I guess it's somewhere else in the book, they give over their power to a nice guy, a scholar who's going to protect them, a protector, and the protector turns into a tyrant.
As I was looking through the book, these numerous parallels came through. But one that didn't, or maybe it did in a strange way, is the role of the, quote, family in Fahrenheit 451. The family in this book is a three-wall video screen, in essence, of recurrent characters. It's kind of a television writ large. But you've spoken already quite a bit about children and how children learn. And what we're seeing now in the banning of books, and I'm not sure, maybe you can speak to how your experience with book banning played into this, is that often it is for the sake of the children that these things are banned. Certain books are not allowed because they may contaminate children with their ideas.
Yeah.
And it's either that or where, if we talk about funding for the arts or for public broadcasting, they talk about the lack of money, that we don't have the money to spend on these things. Meanwhile, NASA, I think, has lost three satellites in the last 2 weeks. worth billions of dollars.
You're mixing things up here because NASA, that $1 billion, let's say, employed hundreds of thousands of people, and they were in turn educated in schools, and the money went in directly into people. Huh? It's not just space. I've had to argue this for years. I know Mr. Golden, the new head of NASA the last year. He's a brilliant man, and he's got a tough fight here. Because I was on TV the night we landed on the moon, and little Bernadette Devlin, that jerk, that Irish jerk, was on with me, and she was flapping her tongue. And I said, you know what your problem is? The back part of your tongue's not connected to your brain. And I said, you think all that money's been spent on the moon? We take shovels and put the money up there? It's been spent right here to improve the future, to give people hope for the future. So we have to separate that out from this other problem. If you take money away from our greatest hope is space travel, it's a substitute for war, for a change. We've never had a real substitute where we could go strain ourselves and force ourselves and be better than we ever hoped to be, because war denigrates and destroys. And we have all those tanks lying there, and they're going to lie there forever and not do anything for anyone. But once we get on the moon and we colonize it and we go to Mars, then our future is insured for the whole human race. And everyone on Earth will look up at the same moment and celebrate. So they're two separate things here. Yeah, two separate things.
Yet you have an ability. I think you're one of the first science fiction writers historically, to perceive technology in human terms. When everybody else was writing about the thrill of being out in space as a rocket jockey, you were writing about the widow and orphan on Earth.
That's right. Combinations of all sorts of things. And the Martian Chronicles is, you know, a blend of romance and fantasy and terror and practicality. The one story in there will come soft rains. 40 years ago, you couldn't build that house. Today, you could build it. If you did build it.
Oh, today.
You could do it for $100,000, and back then, it would have cost millions. Yeah. So I'm like everyone else. I'm conservative liberal, or liberal conservative. Most people are. They put labels on themselves. It doesn't mean a thing. It comes down to humanity, and this whole problem, we're not dealing with censorship today. We're dealing with taste. Individual school boards may eliminate a book for a semester, but that's not censorship. That's taste for that year, and the book comes back the following year. And it's not permanent. If the government were doing this totally, it would be censorship.
Yet Fahrenheit 451, along with, I think it was Slaughterhouse-5, was burned in Indiana and a university in the last five years.
Yeah, one little case. You know, that's not... Well, you can't turn that into a million cases, huh? And these people write me and say, would you come help? I say, no. And they say, why not? I said, if I show up, I'll dignify these sons of bitches. Huh? You deal with them directly. I would dramatize their lives. They'd take advantage of my fame if I showed up. But you deal with them. You're the librarian. When they leave the library, you put the book back on the shelf. Huh? And they come in a month later, and say, how did that book get on the shelf? Gee, I don't know. Huh? And they take it off again, and you put it back again. And they take it off again, and you put it back. That's what the fight is. Huh? And... as far as funding for the arts, there shouldn't be such a thing, because we've got 30,000 artists. How do you pick them? You're going to pick the Impressionists? They're still around, huh? You're going to leave them out? They're not avant-garde, huh? You're going to pick only the avant-garde? Well, then you leave out the Impressionists. See, it's too complicated, huh? And anyway, you can go form your own art gallery and hang your pictures. It's a free society. There is no censorship of this sort of thing. And people like to think that there is, but I knew a group of artists in L.A. a few years ago, 30 of them, sculptors, workers in copper, inscriptions on copper, jewelry, sculpture, oil paintings, and they went and rented a space in Farmer's Market. They each put in $50 a month, and they hung their pictures and brought in their art things, and by God, at the end of 2 years, they were all in business, and they were selling their pictures, see? So you don't need help from the government. You should do it yourself, huh? And if people like you, they'll buy you, huh? I've known, I'm art-oriented. I have thousands of pictures I've collected. I've designed the covers on most of my own books. So I know what I'm talking about. And we shouldn't depend on government to do any of these things. I don't want money from the government to write a play. I was foolish enough 30 years ago to put in for a government fund in the Guggenheim. Well, it went nowhere, thank God, huh? I put on my own plays finally for $5,000, $100. You don't need money to put on a play. You need a storefront. You rent the storefront, or someone gives it to you for an evening. You tell 40 friends to bring their own chairs. And they bring the chairs into the storefront, and you put up little risers, you know, and you get up in the center stage. And Shakespeare said, when in doubt, stand in the middle of the stage, face the audience, and speak. That's what theater is.
What was the telephone number to subscribe to WBAI? Is 212.
But of course, the argument on the other side of it is that the government money is our money. It's our money, and why shouldn't we take a piece of it?
Well, because you cannot get from the people a vote on what kind of art they want to buy, huh?
It's self-determination if people give the money where they wish.
What if they're all Seurat lovers and Monet and Manet lovers, and there's still artists like that painting today, and the people who give money to the government say, well, give some to these people, huh? It's got to be fair, not just Andy Warhol or whoever, Jasper Johns, if you like him. But it's got to be completely fair, and it hasn't been. Huh? The ordinary artist of the past who paints well has been left out. Yeah.
I'd like to sneak in one more question about Fahrenheit 451.
Sure.
Do you believe that Truffaut captured the vision?
Part of it. The last reel especially. Every time I see it, I cry because it's beautiful. It's the book people walking in the snowfalls and repeating the names of the books and the wonderful music by Bernard Herrmann.
Oh, a great soundtrack.
But still, things were left out. And somewhere up ahead, I'd like to do the book, do the complete book, just shoot it right off the page.
Have you written a screenplay?
The book is the screenplay. And everything of mine is a screenplay. And I grew up, I've seen thousands of films, starting when I was 3, 1923, Hunchback of Notre Dame, Phantom of the Opera when I was 5. And when I met Sam Peckinpah 20 years ago, he wanted to do a film with me, Something Wicked. And I said, Sam, how are you going to do it? He says, I'm going to rip the pages out of the book and stuff them in the camera. I said, that's right. Yeah, because I didn't discover this about myself until I was older. And you pick up any page of any of my books, and it's in shots. Huh? Yeah. Close up, long shots. Huh? Yeah.
It's been an honor.
Yes, thank you.
For me, too. Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, that was a better interview than I remembered. And it was later than I said. It was the mid-90s. In fact, it was July 2000. So about a mere 12 years ago. And again, thank you to Matthew Finch for having been the facilitator of that interview. And it goes without saying thank you, Ray Bradbury, for a lifetime, more than a lifetime of memories in among many, many of the eulogies that have been written for Bradbury in the last 8 days since his passing. A lot of them were as poetic as Bradbury's writing as well. And I think the key thing that so many people remember is how well his writing lasts within us. I have to admit, not having reread so much of Bradbury in so many years and still remembering it all. And as people mention this or that, some things I may have forgotten or not, they bring up echoes. And he is one of those people, when a lot of the writers of yesteryear are forgot, and many are, I can mention certainly a lot of the people who I was reading in the digests of the 60s and later, a lot of them are not well remembered. It is an easy thing to say that Bradbury will never be among them. Bradbury's writing will go on. More movies will be made of his work. Hopefully, not terrible. But one never knows. There have been bad adaptations. The Beast of 20,000 Fathoms. So some of them, Bradbury wrote the screenplay himself. So there's no excuse. But, you know, there's always... he was an Academy Award nominee, if not winner, for Moby Dick. Well, let us move on and actually listen to a little bit of Bradbury. This, again, courtesy of the archives of Max Schmid.
Adventures in time and space, told in future tense.
Dimension X.
The National Broadcasting Company.
By the way, this is from 1951. Smith,
publishers of Astounding Science Fiction bring you Dimension X. Twenty years had passed since the last of the giant migration ships had crashed to the surface of Mars, bearing its pitiful handful of survivors of the Earth Wars. 20 years of scratching at the stubborn Martian soil. 20 years of trying to devise new solar engines that would use the strange fuel they found on Mars. 20 years of longing, of turning eyes toward the green Earth as it hung on the horizon like a beckoning light. And now it was done. And the first new ship, built of shining Martian chromaton, had lifted bravely toward home with 3 men locked in its metal belly. Would they return to an Earth made barren by cosmic dust, to a blackened radioactive hell? Or would they find intelligence still alive on the scourged planet? What had 20 years of death and radioactivity done to our beloved Earth?
That's it, Captain. We've intersected the course vector.
Williams.
Yes, sir.
Prepare for deceleration.
Forward fission ready, Captain.
Read us off, Evans.
We'll enter the gravitational field of the Earth in exactly 10 seconds. 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3.
Fire 2 and 4.
1.
2 and 4.
What's our momentum, Evans?
-3.
Fire 1.
1.
-4 now.
Steady as she goes. How are we?
On parabola now. If we can hold, we should breach the heaviside layer somewhere north of what used to be Murmansk.
Let's have a look at her. Visor, please.
Yes, sir.
Mother Earth.
20 years. We're going home, Evans. We're going home.
Home to what, Captain? Home to a burned-out radioactive planet that is incapable of supporting human life?
Evans and I don't agree with that, Williams. We think the Earth is ready for us again, that she'll give us another chance.
I'm sorry, Captain, but I was born and brought up on Mars under the new central government. We younger men disagree with you about migrating back to Earth. For us, Mars is home.
Well, we'll see.
If there is some form of life on Earth, we'll find out soon enough.
Williams, head for New York.
It is, Captain. You can barely see the top of the Atomic Trades Building in the twilight. They never finished building it.
Dark as a tomb. Slow to cruising speed.
Cruising speed.
It begins to look as if Williams is right, Captain. Not a sign of life on 4 continents.
Well, we'll make a radiation check and then head back for Mars.
Do you agree with me, gentlemen, that for all practical purposes, the planet is dead?
It's still my Captain. What is it?
Am I going out of my mind? Look out that way to the west. Could that be...
By heaven, it is. Those are lights. Turn the ship.
Heading west, southwest.
Full speed.
Full speed.
They are lights. Captain, it's a city, a whole blasted city lit up like a Christmas tree. Well, what do you think of your dead planet now, Williams?
We shall see, Evans. Remember, the Commission wants evidence of life as we know it.
Decelerate to negative 5. We're going to take her down. There's an open area just on the edge of the city.
Yes, sir.
Hold on, gentlemen. We're about to land.
Landing jacks are down, sir.
Open the airlock. Close. All right, gentlemen. Before we go out, security at all times. Williams, you have the blast gun?
I have it.
If anyone becomes separated, fire a shot and make for the ship. How's the radiation, Evans?
Safe enough so far. This seems to be a light area.
Very well. Open the lock.
Oh, it's unbelievable. We've been walking for hours now and not a soul to be seen.
There must be someone. How do you explain the lights?
I don't know. Municipal building.
Shall we have a look here, sir? Possibly the records might contain some clue.
Good idea. Keep your weapons ready. This door is in good working order. Almost as if it had been oiled recently. Long corridor. Lights blazing in every office. William, stand to watch here in the corridor. Fire a blast if you need us.
Yes, sir.
Evans, you come with me. We'll start right here with the city clerk's office. Better check radiation again.
Not enough to do any damage.
Gives you the creeps, doesn't it? Look at this desk. Papers crumpled. Inkstand. Just as if somebody came in and worked here every day. Calendar. June 18th, 1987.
Why, that's the day of the evacuation. The dust cloud had already blanketed New York and was heading west.
Dog licenses, hunting permits.
Somehow I have a peculiar feeling that... Good Lord.
Pick it up, Evans.
Hello? No answer. Hello? I hear something. A scratching sort of noise.
Good day, Doctor.
What?
How are you? I called to ask some advice about a trepanning problem. Can you tell me if the lateral cut should be made first?
Hello. Hello. This is absolutely
Thank
insane.
You,
Hello.
Doctor. I'll do that. By the way, how is your wife, Alice? And the girls? And your son, John? Fine boy, John. I'll call again tomorrow. Goodbye, Doctor.
Hello. Hello. It's gone dead.
Who was it?
I don't know. A strange voice carried on a conversation about some surgical operation without paying the slightest attention to anything I said. Captain, the lights are out.
Good Lord.
Captain! Captain!
I have a torch. Come on. Williams, what is it?
I don't know.
You fired a shot.
Yes, sir. Just as the lights went out, I'm sure I saw a figure. It looked like an old man in a white robe. It moved across the end of the corridor down that way.
Flash your torch down there, Evans. Nothing there. Are you certain, Williams?
I'm not certain. The lights.
They're on again.
We're going to get to the bottom of this.
Wait.
What?
Listen. Quietly. Someone is coming, walking slowly toward the corridor.
Coming closer. Cover him when he turns the corner.
It'll be a pleasure.
Don't fire unless I give the word.
Shh. What? Jumping Jupiter.
Are you... Is it really someone, or am I having hallucinations?
We are no vision.
No. No, you seem to be real. I saw the ship come down. I thought perhaps I was losing my mind. It's been so many years.
I'm Captain John Parsons. These are my assistants, Dr. Evans and Mr. Williams. We've returned to Earth from Mars.
Then It's happened. We're not alone anymore. Forgive me, gentlemen. I seem moved. I waited and hoped for so long.
You survived the radiation?
We did.
There are others?
My family were the only ones.
I answered the phone a moment ago. Who was it?
You heard my voice, Doctor.
Your voice?
To break the loneliness, I've recorded my voice and rigged up an automatic telephone. It's pleasant to hear the phone ring. I come here to do my work.
I take it you're a medical man.
My name's Cornelius Hathaway.
Hathaway? Hathaway, the brain surgeon?
You know my name.
Who doesn't? I watched you on television at college. I saw you 23 years ago. You performed the difficult surgery for a cerebral tumor. Marvelous.
Thank you. I'd almost forgotten. My mind, you see, I'm almost 80 now.
You look fine, sir.
Well, we've had the best of everything. An entire city to choose from. Cold storage, the best equipment. But come, when I saw your ship, I told Alice, my wife, you know, to prepare a feast. This is a great day for me, gentlemen. A great, great day. This is my wife, gentlemen. Alice, this is Captain Parsons, Dr. Evans, and Mr. Williams.
How do you do, Mrs. Hathaway?
Now, if you'll follow me, gentlemen, we'll meet my children.
Lord, what a beautiful woman.
She looks no more than 35.
These are my daughters, Susan and Marguerite. This is my son, John.
How are you, gentlemen? Nice,
well, sit down, gentlemen, sit down. We'll have a feast in honor of this occasion. Susan, Marguerite, get the best silverware and the damask napkins. John, fetch the glasses.
Oh, yes, Father. It'll only take...
Excuse me, John.
Sir?
How old are you?
23, sir.
Thank you.
Now, if you'll excuse me.
What is it, Captain? Something wrong?
Nothing except that it's impossible. You see, Dr. Hathaway's son was already in college when I started. That would make him at least 45. That was a wonderful meal, Mrs. Hathaway. Doctor, your wife is an exceptional woman.
Thank you, sir.
How would you gentlemen like some fresh gingerbread with your coffee? I baked it this morning.
Oh, wonderful. Smell that, Evans?
Oh, it's like coming home, Mrs. Hathaway.
We enjoy having you here.
Mrs. Hathaway, may I compliment you on your having preserved your youth and beauty so well?
Thank you. We have had no worries here, no competition. Only the things we need for material comfort.
Parsons and I were wondering, Dr. Hathaway, if the radioactivity had any effect in preserving tissue. Your children all look so young, too.
It is possible, gentlemen, of course. Radiation does strange things to living tissue. Alice, could we have some champagne?
Of course. I'll only be a moment.
An amazing woman. Did you ever see such grace? Such complete relaxation.
It doesn't seem quite natural.
I beg your pardon, gentlemen?
Captain Parsons was just about to ask how you and your family managed to escape, Dr. Hathaway.
You were very fortunate. I was working in the Sierra Mountains at the time. I had a lead-lined laboratory where I did X-ray research on my pet project.
And what is that, sir?
The study of machines as they relate to human function and the corollary of... Well, to continue, when the dust cloud covered America, we remained in the laboratory, well supplied with food and water. Later, when the radiation permitted, we made our way east, back to our old home, in the hopes of finding other survivors. But by that time, every living creature had been evacuated to Mars. We were stranded. The migration ships didn't wait for stragglers.
That's true. My father and I were on the last rocket out of New York.
I've always loved this old house. But the loneliness of those first years...
At least you had your wife and children.
Yes. Yes, I had my family. If it were not for them, gentlemen, I assure you I would long ago have put a bullet in my head.
Here we are. Champagne, Captain.
Oh, thank you, Mrs. Hathaway. May May I propose a toast?
Oh, let me. Gentlemen, to Earth.
To Earth.
Earth.
May she never be a stranger to man again.
Hathaway, what is it?
Nothing really. It's just a rather sharp pain in the chest.
I think you should lie down, Doctor.
No. Yes.
Perhaps you're right.
Let me help you.
No. John and Susan will help.
Of course, Father.
Why don't you gentlemen go out on the porch, enjoy the air? I'll see you all in the morning.
Good night, Doctor.
Good night. Come, John.
Yes, Father.
Well, what do you think of old Mother Earth now, Williams? Smell that summer breeze. Look at that view of the city lighted up against the sky.
It has a certain quality.
Well, score 1 point for the back-to-earth proponent.
I didn't say that.
You're beginning to feel it, though, Williams. I can tell.
If you don't mind, gentlemen, I'm quite tired. I think I'll turn in. Excuse me.
Well, Captain?
Well, what?
What do you make of all this?
I don't know what you mean.
This Hathaway and his family, there's something strange and unnatural going on here. I can sense it.
I think you're reading things into it, Evans.
Oh, perhaps. Well, I'll turn in too. Are you coming?
In a moment. I want to smoke a cigarette.
Beautiful view.
What?
Is it not?
I didn't hear you come out. How is he?
Resting. I've never seen him this bad.
Yes, he's an old man. I'm sorry, but the difference in your ages is so apparent. You must have been married very young.
My husband is a very great man, Captain. It's too bad there was no one to appreciate him. Once, he wired the whole city with sound speakers, and when he pressed a button, the whole town lit up and made noises, as if 10,000 people were living in it.
He must have been very lonesome for people. Although with a woman such as you, I don't understand.
Perhaps one day you will understand. Good night, Captain.
Good night, Mrs. Hathaway.
Captain. Captain Parsons.
Who's there?
It's Dr. Evans.
What time is it?
2 a.m.
What's wrong?
I couldn't sleep. A few minutes ago, I heard someone slip out the front door. The moonlight, I saw it was the old man. He was headed toward our ship.
What are you suggesting, Evans?
Nothing, except that it's fairly unnatural for an old man with a bad heart to go wandering off at 2 in the morning.
Very well. We'll follow him. See him yet?
No.
Look. Ahead there on the hillside. Isn't that Hathaway kneeling in the moonlight?
Yes, I think so. Can we get closer?
Let's head for that clump of bushes. This is far enough.
What do you suppose he's doing there? What are those things on the ground?
Good Lord. Those are grave markers. 4 of them.
You're right. Seems to be praying over them.
Listen.
Do you forgive me for what I've done? I had to do it. I was so terribly lonely. You do forgive me, don't you? Yes, I feel you do. I'm glad. I think perhaps I can rest now. I think I...
He's having another attack. Come on. Hathaway! Dr. Hathaway. Raise his head, Evans.
His lips are moving.
What is it, Doctor?
Lean closer. I'm sorry I had to spoil all of this. I've expected it for some time.
We'll fix you up.
No, this is the end for me. It really doesn't matter. Except for them.
What about them, Hathaway?
You suspected, didn't you?
Yes, I suspected, but I couldn't believe it until now. Do they know?
No. No, they wouldn't understand. I wouldn't want them to know ever. The earth. The earth.
Don't try to talk.
The earth is so fair.
Doctor.
He's dead, Captain. He knew it was the end this time.
Yes, he knew.
What was it he meant about your suspecting?
Light a match, Evans. Look on those four grave markers and tell me what you see.
Good Lord.
Well?
Alice Hathaway. Marguerite Hathaway. Susan Hathaway. John Hathaway. Died July 1987. But that's 20 years ago. If these markers are correct, then who are those others?
Can't you guess, Evans? Can't you guess? Mrs. Hathaway, are you awake?
Yes, Captain.
May I come in?
Yes. It's about my husband, isn't it?
You knew.
I saw him go out tonight. He felt it was near the end.
He died less than an hour ago. I'm sorry.
Thank you.
How do you feel?
He told us it would happen one day, and that he didn't want us to cry. He didn't teach us how, you know. He said it was the worst thing that could happen, to know how to be lonely and unhappy. What will happen to us now that he's gone?
I don't know.
Will you stay with us?
I would like to, but I cannot.
You know about us.
Yes, I know. I didn't think that you knew yourself.
The children don't. I've been aware for a long while.
No one would have guessed. You're so perfect.
Oh, he would have liked to hear you say that. He was so very proud of us. After a while, he came to love us. And at the end, he took us as his real wife and children. He even forgot sometimes that he had made us.
You gave him a great deal of comfort.
Yes. Over the years, we sat and talked. He loved so much to talk. I was first, you know. Then he became lonesome for the children. And so he made them. He told me about the things he did, about his laboratory.
Well, surely the children must suspect.
Oh, no. You see, there were no other beings with which to compare themselves.
He must have been a great, great genius.
Each morning he took a recording of his voice into town and put it on the automatic telephone. Each night it would call us. I think, what with the phone ringing and the sound of voices and the lights on, he was happy. There was only one thing, one flaw.
And that?
He couldn't make us grow old. And so he had to watch himself become an old, old man while we stayed young. It was a great blow to him.
And so we commend the body of this man, Cornelius Hathaway, to his maker. Ashes to ashes, dust to dust returneth. Amen.
Come, John.
Yes, Mother.
Susan. Marguerite.
Evans, Williams, stay here a moment, please.
What is it?
Let them go back to the house. I want to speak to you.
I know what you're going to tell us, Captain. I saw the names on the grave markers.
Well?
It's a mockery. A blasphemy of everything we believe in. For a man to do something so evil.
Can't you imagine what he faced? Can't you imagine what it must have been like to have watched his wife and children die slowly of radiation burns? To know that he was the last man on the face of the earth? Alone? Eternally and unalterably alone? Good Lord, man, what would you have done if you'd had his medical and technical genius?
That's incredible.
Yes, it is. But with an entire American city on which to draw for supplies and equipment, a brilliant man might accomplish anything, even that.
What are you suggesting, Captain? That we take them back?
We haven't enough space in the ship for that. Every ounce counts. Still, to leave them here, like that, alone.
I think I have an answer, cold-blooded as it may seem.
Go on.
I suggest that we turn them off.
Do you think that I could do that?
No, but I could. After all, they aren't human. They're worse than robots. They're ghoulish.
Have you talked to her? Has she smiled at you with that quiet, beautiful smile?
Captain, we can't take them with us, and it would be less than human to leave them here without Hathaway.
Could you do it, Evans?
Give me the blast gun, Williams.
We'll wait on the ship. Take off in half an hour.
Half an hour.
He should be back soon.
Yes.
He's doing the only humane thing, Captain. They are less than human.
Are they?
Well, it's done now, and no one will ever... That's the airlock. He's back.
Well?
Here's your gun.
Did you do it?
When I entered the house, she looked at me with those fine, intelligent eyes. I couldn't do it. It would be murder, cold-blooded murder.
I prayed you wouldn't be able to do it. There will never be anything as fine as they are. Built to last 200, 300, perhaps 1,000 years. Well, get the course in the integrator, Williams. We'll take off in 20 minutes. I should be back by then.
You're going out, sir?
I'm going to say goodbye.
Come back.
Only to say goodbye.
It was nice of you.
I wanted you to know that I am coming back someday.
When will you come?
I don't know. It will take many years to prepare fuel for another trip. 6, 7, perhaps 10 years.
I will watch the sky at night, just as he watched it.
Oh. I'm afraid I must go now.
I understand. Strange. I have a new feeling. One which he did not teach us. A feeling of longing. Of sadness.
That one is not taught. It comes of being alive.
Yes. I am alive. Even though he created me, I'm a person now.
Goodbye, Alice Hathaway.
Goodbye, John Parsons.
Have just heard another adventure into the unknown world of the future. The world of...
Dimension X.
That's from 1951. They talk about the far-flung future of 1989. Yeah, I love that stuff. In the year 2000, I did a whole series of shows of science fiction stories set in the far-flung future of the year 2000. And retro SF into the future, forward into the past, and all that good stuff is wonderful stuff. Anyhow, that was, again, Dwellers in Silence by Ray Bradbury. And I'm not going to say that this is the end of the Ray Bradbury tribute, because with James Gates and Felix Gilman, we did a Bradbury tribute last week, and I don't have a set agenda yet for next week or the week after. All I can say is, and actually, no, the week after I do have Gay Partington Terry will be our guest. But we'll be doing Bradbury tributes for a long, long time. There is too much wonderful material that he gave us. I could do an entire show with nothing but songs based on Bradbury's writing. I can think of, there was an album called Dark Carnival. There's the song that I played a portion of last week called The Rocket Man by Tom Rapp with Pearls Before Swine. And actually Tom Rapp did at least two Bradbury songs. The wealth that he left us, good movies, bad movies, wonderful prose, some not as wonderful epic poems, but most importantly, a sense of a purism in thinking, a simplistic, he could see the dark and he saw the light at the same time, and he presented those as very much a part of what was great and terrible about society. You could see the world of Fahrenheit 451, in which, you know, the burning of books would be commonplace, and yet the spirit would exist within to get out from under. And he saw that, although the movie is a French film, François Truffaut, Truffaut made it in English, he saw this as a very American thing, the good and the bad of it. He was very, very, very American in his writing, in the best and worst senses of it. Or he was in the best sense, but he saw the darkness of it at the same time. A remarkable person who we're all the richer for having had him share his concepts of culture with us. And we will continue to share concepts of culture in science fiction and fantasy and Ray Bradbury on this program every week. Let me make a few announcements. I should have done this near the top of the show, but I'm out of my head with the heat. This room is quite something. I complained about it last week. Let me do so this week. But I'll try to use it for an excuse. But let's see. Announcement number one, readings. Readings are always very, very important. And one which is not as well known, the Kindred Readings series. KGB readings will be happening next Wednesday, and Eugene Myers, E.C. Myers, will be one of the readers there. And to find out more about that, Google up KGB Fantastic Fiction and go to the website, and I will hopefully I will see you there. I'm not sure. Wednesday night readings are a difficulty for me since I have this Wednesday night radio show. But Tuesday night, I promise you, I will be attending the Kindred reading series. Kindred named after the story by Octavia Butler, which is an appropriate name for this reading series, a wonderful one, because it is mostly features writers of color. And the two readers next time will be Kiini Ibura-Salam, who was on this show a long time ago, and we're going to have to reintroduce ourselves to her. She wrote me an email, and we're going to set that up. But I'll be seeing her next week, and I hope you will as well. Her bio, a writer, painter, and traveler from New Orleans, Louisiana. Her fiction, which has been widely anthologized, is included in Dark Matter, Dark Arrows, and Mood. Mojo. What am I saying? Mojo. Conjure Stories. She will be reading from her forthcoming collection of stories. cool. Ancient, being published by Aqueduct Press. Aqueduct Press does wonderful stuff. And the other reader will be Jennifer Marie Brissett, Jen Brissett, a Jamaican-American Brit. She is a writer, artist, and former bookseller. She had a way cool bookstore in Brooklyn, which I am so sorry doesn't exist anymore, Indigo Cafe and Books. But a bookstore that is remembered by many classically. So suffice it to say that this is happening next Tuesday, starting at 7 o'clock. It will be occurring at the Nova Bar in Brooklyn at 884 Pacific Street in Brooklyn, New York. And for more information, go to Facebook, if you're a member of Facebook, and look up Kindred Reading Series, and that will tell you more. And if you can't find it there, send me an email, and I will forward you all of the information on this. And my email address is Jim, J-I-M, at ourwolf.com, ourwolf.com. And I will forward you this. Not that just suffice it to say that I particularly push that one because it's not as well known, this reading series. I certainly hadn't heard of it until now. And so, it needs that much of an extra push. Not to say that KGB Fantastic Fiction is in the mainstream, but next Wednesday, KGB Fantastic Fiction. Put that on your calendar as well. But this Saturday, ha-ha, jaunty, jingly jaunt, this Saturday is Bloomsday. And as such, you should do multiple events for Bloomsday. One, of course, is tuning in to WBAI for our annual Radio Bloomsday broadcast starting at 7 p.m., I believe it is, and then going into the wee hours when Molly will say, yes, I will. And if you want to share that will with Molly, well, be sure to tune in. And yes, that will be after 10 p.m. We'll be in safe harbor. Then on, but earlier that day, on Bloomsday itself, well, of course, there is the Ulysses Saturday at the Bar Ulysses at 95 Pearl Street. Starting at 2 o'clock, your master of ceremonies will be Simon Lokley. And he writes me, I have a passage set aside with you in mind, the Gothic horror parody. So this sounds like something really worthwhile. I'm going to try to make that myself this coming Saturday. At any rate, enjoy your Bloomsday. I hope you all find what it is that you are looking for in that day. And in the meantime, stay tuned for Burn Baby Burn Clappers with Lister coming your way on these same airwaves. And have a wonderful week. And enjoy yourselves. Thank you for listening. I'll be back next Wednesday night, Thursday morning at 1:30 a.m. Eastern Time. Please tune in and enjoy yourselves.
admit it, I am a proletarian. I am
the
bitch.
The red, white, and blue who spit on you.
Myself, torching the symbol of oppression. Let that be a lesson to those that want suppression of the truth. Put on hold, the bold lose control, so they force obedience. Have you pledge allegiance to a piece of cloth? That's off the way I see it. Well, I'm going off berserk, cause the system work to jerk. My people, the people, all around the pigs work. Tell me I'm wrong, though, that's my right, and it's right in the Constitution. Yo, that's an illusion, huh? Suckers trying to change and rearrange. They say that I'm free, but they sure have a strange way of showing it. But I'm blowing the cover, the red, white, the blue, but the black for the brother. And I'm the lover of this flag, like many others take the same turn. Like me, they yearn for the flag too. Burn the material of the imperialist in a blazing inferno, cause my hurt is internal. The American dream, a nightmare. To wake up to the lies, the pigs make up imperialistic swans that I grind into bacon bits. Call it fist, cause I ain't taking. I'm not a Nazi or a Cappy or a Farmy, but you want me in prison cause I'm messy attack. The flag, I ragging and snagging and dragging and rip it to shreds, cause I'm too black, too strong, too red, too dread. And I'm dreaded cause I make the pigs tremble when I burn a symbol. Yo, I'm quick and nimble like Jack, but I'm a black man attacking the flag. I keep my torch handy, I'm no Yankee Doodle Dandy, so just hand me a flag from the fascists and watch me burn that piece of to ash. Cause the real meaning is what the masses must learn. That's why the red, white, and blue must burn, baby, burn.
I'm not scared of you. Your flag, the
this new rule and I want y'all to learn it. Strike a match to the American flag and burn.
Thank you. Oh, bear, is it me? I drank the water.